Good morning. This is Kevin Patrick. You're listening to Undercurrent. Today, we're going to continue our discussion on fossil fuel depletion. We started the series off with Shell Alaklet and the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas. Today, our guest is Dale Allen Pfeiffer. He's a geologist, science journalist, musician, poet, contributing editor to From the Wilderness, and he's the author of The End of the Oil Age and also a new novel, Giants in Their Steps. Last time I had a live guest, it was Shell, and we discussed the basics of peak oil and how we've gotten to where we are. And so now I'd like to discuss where we're headed and what the outlook is for society after the peak as we start to decline in oil production and natural gas production. So where do you see us standing right now?
Oh, right now, we are at peak, or just approaching peak. We're at the point where there's not a whole lot of spare capacity remaining, not a whole lot that we can continue producing, or not a whole lot of growth remaining in oil production. We haven't actually began the decline yet. Probably the last time you talked with, I'll probably mispronounce his name here.
Shell. Shell Alaklet.
Yes. He probably told you about Colin Campbell and others about their projections and where they consider the peak to actually take place and the decline to begin. Most predictions looking at the latest data suggest in about 2 years. Right now what we're seeing is a big, massive increase in demand, which is outstripping supply, because supply just can't grow at the same rate anymore. Part of this massive demand is due to the emerging Asian economies, especially China, India, and Indonesia. And they are basically motoring up and modernizing and attempting to achieve the same sort of living standard and the same style of living as the United States. And as the world is finding out, there just simply isn't enough available energy for everybody to live the way people do in this country.
And I noticed in an article you wrote recently for From the Wilderness, you said that oil prices might actually drop towards the end of the year, but it's kind of just a false hope because it's mainly just drilling into reserves that we've already discovered years ago, and so we're just kind of draining those last few.
Yeah, there's a lag time between discovery and bringing a field online. The last major discoveries, and they weren't really major, they were 500 million barrel fields. They call them mega fields. They're not really huge fields, but they're good size. The last major discovery we had of fields in that size range was in 2003, those fields are going to be brought online this year and next year. However, by the year 2007, there will be no major new discoveries brought online. And at that time, they expect that production will start slipping and will not be able to keep up with demand whatsoever.
So even with these, even with the tapping in, I think I counted in your article roughly 30 to 35 fields in the next few years that they're going to be tapping into. Even with that, we're still just keeping pace with current demand?
Yes, these aren't, you know, major fields. They're big fields, but they're not like, oh, for instance, the size of the North Sea field or the North Slope field of Alaska, or, you know, nowhere near the size of Gawar and Saudi Arabia. According to the mathematical models of oil production, demand, and everything, we would need five or six fields the size of the North Sea. and we would need to bring them online before the peak in order to have any sort of effect in delaying the peak. And five or six fields the size of the North Sea would only delay the peak for a few years. If we make those discoveries after the peak and bring them online, they really won't have any effect on the peak. They'll create sort of a secondary hump on the way down in the production profile. Sort of the same, you can see that sort of thing in the United States production profile. If you look at it, there's the big peak occurs 1970, but there's a secondary peak farther down the slope when the North Slope oil was brought online. It didn't replace what we were using or what we had produced up to 1970, but it helped alleviate the situation.
And I hate to admit this, but I was actually listening to the Sean Hannity show on the way home from work the other day. Yeah, I know. I was just flipping through channels. And he brought out the old argument that the reason, you know, one of the reasons our oil prices are so high is that environmental extremists have kept us from building a refining capacity to keep up with, you know, the oil, you know, to refine oil fast enough to keep the prices down. And is it not true that the major oil companies are just not building refineries because they know what most people don't, that it's not a good investment at this point to build a refinery for oil that isn't there?
Yeah, that's the truth. They don't want to invest the money in a refinery where they're not going to make back their investment. The same goes for big oil tankers. They don't want to build very many of them because they don't see a return on their investment. That's the bottom line there.
Once we go over the peak and once oil starts to become harder to extract and more expensive, what do you think the initial ramifications will be, say, on industry and shipping and the global trade system?
Oh, well, that's kind of hard to foresee because we're traveling into new territory. In the history of mankind, we've never been in the position that we are coming to now. Throughout the history of mankind, there have always been other energy resources to turn to, greater energy resources. You look at the history of technology, the Industrial Revolution. If you look at a population curve, basically what you're seeing is a reflection of the amount of energy available to civilization. And there's been growth. First 20,000 years or so of civilization, that growth was very slow. Then as you get up to the Industrial Age, you see the population growth jump, and what caused it to jump was not just the discovery of coal, but the discovery of how to use coal to release the energy. And then the population really jumps once we started using oil. And throughout the last century, it's raised exponentially. And now we're at the point where the energy resources that all of this growth is based upon are going to begin declining. We've never been in that position before. We can look at populations of other animals that have been in a position where they lost their energy base, and we can see what we see is chaos, the population die off, and then the species levels off at a new population.
You're listening to WGDR Plainfield, 91.1 FM. It's a few minutes after noon. You're listening to Dale Allen Pfeiffer. We're discussing the post peak situation with fossil fuels and where we're headed and how it could affect us in this country and on a global scale. So I'm sorry you were talking about other populations of species that have experienced a peak in their energy supply.
Yeah. The picture for humans is of course much more complicated because we have this complex civilization, this socioeconomic structure, and you know we've never had a look at how such a structure would react to energy depletion before. There are a lot of suggestions, and probably the most obvious thing is that our economy cannot continue to grow once the energy input begins to diminish.
At the same time, we're entering this situation where we've reached a peak in fossil fuel production, or near the peak, that we've fractured our production and distribution to the point where we're not producing things anywhere near where we need and where we're utilizing them, and so it's going to make it much, much tougher, like you said, to figure out.
Yes. Globalization will most probably be reversed. Things are going to have to localize again. And that could lead to big problems in the short term, because everything has production has been so spread around the world that a lot of the local infrastructure for supporting local economies is no longer there. It has to be redeveloped, and there's a big question as to whether there is the financial support to even do that. And with our massive budget deficit, various state deficits.
Other countries are going to look, as they invest and understand this peak oil situation, they're going to look at societies that are more, I would say, more geared towards adapting to a post-fossil fuel age. Europe, which they still have much more mass transit, and they're more localized in many ways, and versus, say, the U.S., which has got an awful situation for mass transit, and our agribusiness, we use trucks to transport most of our food, hundreds to even 1,000 miles away from where they're being used, and so they may look at us as not a very good investment and further our dollar decline even more.
Yes, there's already a lot of evidence that is happening, and there are some people suggesting that various countries, mainly China, possibly Russia, and a few other countries have plans for economic warfare with the U.S. based on the dollar reserves that they hold and the portion of the trade deficit which they hold.
So while we're the self-proclaimed number one superpower militarily, we have commitments, financial commitments, to these other countries who can call in their markers and make it much difficult for us to function in the global system.
Yes, and then the fact that the dollar is a fiat currency, it's not tied to a gold standard. Really, the only standard the dollar is tied to is oil, the petrodollar. And should the oil market destabilize, or should the dollar destabilize to the point that OPEC, say, were to switch over to euros, then the dollar would simply collapse. There would be nothing to back it with.
Michael Clare, he's a professor at Amherst, I believe, Amherst and Hampshire College. But he was talking about how one of the reasons we may be ramping up against Iran is they want to create their own oil market, and they're leaning towards using the euro as the exchange for the oil market. And Iran has, I believe, the second largest oil reserve in the world right now, and the second largest natural gas reserve. And if you combine them together, I think they're right behind Saudi Arabia in combined reserves.
Actually, their oil reserves are third after Iraq, but they're probably second in production right now, because Iraq's production is off so much due to our fiasco there.
And they have a very large upside for production, too, like compared to some other sources. They're producing at something like 50 to 60% of their capacity right now, so they're kind of a key piece in the puzzle.
Yes. Michael Clare, I believe, is totally correct. They are trying to start up an alternative oil market based on the euro, and, of course, the United States doesn't want to see that at all. They are also very close with China, and China has as much as stated that if the U.S. attacks Iran, then China will have to get involved in it in some way, way or other. I doubt that they would send troops there. More probably, they would give the Iranians weaponry.
And in addition to its reserves in fossil fuels and also the ties with China, also they're working with India for a pipeline through, I guess, Pakistan, which is kind of interesting that India and Pakistan are going to actually cooperate on running a pipeline from Iran to India. And Condoleezza Rice expressed distress that those two countries would cooperate, which I thought was kind of strange for a Secretary of State, that cooperation between India and Pakistan was all of a sudden a bad thing.
Yes, it's there has historically been a lot of friction between India and China as well, and they have stood firmly together on the issue of Iran. They have both agreed that they will not react well to any sort of invasion of Iran. China does have a lot of economic clout with the U.S., and they have made threatening sounds about divesting of U.S. dollars and calling in U.S. debts should the U.S. attack Iran. Another country that's aligned itself with Iran is Venezuela. And President Chavez, I should say president-elect, because he is clearly popularly elected in a very fair election as opposed to the U.S. In Venezuela, and he has made a number of statements and signed some agreements that should the U.S. attack Iran, he will stop his oil production or oil shipments to the U.S.
And he's already, I believe it was just last week or so, decided to kind of disconnect with the United States.
Yes, well, it's debatable. You know, U.S. political advisors in South America tend to be destabilizing influences.
They have a long history to have a dual mission. Since we're talking about Iran a lot, because President Bush is talking about Iran a lot, if you look at the positioning, I mean, not only with the fossil fuel reserves in Iran and with their connections with, you know, China and India, and they're also kind of the bridge between the Arab oil and natural gas reserves and the Central Asian reserves. So geographically, they're kind of key, too. They're kind of right in the middle between the two. They're kind of the connection between the two large fossil fuel reserves. And so it's possible that we're trying to settle in there to have our base in the middle so we can kind of control in both directions.
Yes, there is that idea. Of course, there's the offside to it. We go in there. Is it going to be any more settled than Iraq is now, or Afghanistan? You know, how apt are the major players going to be to invest in pipelines running through Iran if the U.S. is occupying the country and the public is resorting to armed resistance. That is, if we are even able to occupy the country.
We just had Tariq Ali. He was recently in Vermont, and I brought that question up when he was speaking in Vermont about Iran. And he seems to believe that we may try some strategic strikes on their nuclear capabilities, but he can't see how we could possibly even attempt an invasion of Iran. And one reason he brought up was that the action in Afghanistan and also in Iraq, neither would have been possible had the mullahs in Iran not given kind of their consent that, you know, it was okay. And so he said it would just be inconceivable that we could go in and actually try an invasion, which could kind of explode the entire region.
That's an interesting view. I hadn't considered that before.
You once read an article and it was, what was it titled? What Will Be the Next Target of the Oil Coup? So if you look at the oil curves, you know, supply curves, production curves around the world. We've spoken about Iran. You've brought up briefly Venezuela. What other areas of the world do you think are going to become of greater interest?
Well, one area that will be of interest is Equatorial Africa.
This is Nigeria in that area?
Nigeria in that area. there isn't a whole lot of oil there compared to the Middle East or even Venezuela. But the oil from that area does not take as long to reach the market in the U.S. as Middle Eastern oil does. It can take a month or more for Middle Eastern oil to reach the United States. It only takes between 1 and 2 weeks for oil from that area of Africa, Nigeria, and around there, to reach the U.S. There's already been a lot of unrest there and a lot of U.S. support for military regimes in the area. There have even been a few small coups in small island nations off the coast of Africa where there have been offshore reserves discovered. And it is an area which will probably see conflict within the next several years if the U.S. continues with its current policy of oil imperialism.
If we try to take charge of the oil resources militarily, it kind of works in contrast because the military actions themselves are so reliant on fossil fuels.
Yes, it's one of the most oil-intensive activities we can undertake. Years ago, when those of us who first became aware of the global oil peak began discussing it among ourselves, we quickly decided that the worst thing that the U.S. could do was precisely what it's doing now, the oil imperialism, the oil wars, that it was the worst reaction we could take. We also felt that it was possibly the most likely reaction, and events seem to have borne that out.
So what have you and some of the other folks you mentioned, like Michael Clare, Michael Rupert, that have been involved in this issue, what do you see as our best options, Richard Heinberg's another, best options going forward to adapt to the situation we're facing with fossil fuel supplies?
Well, I can't speak for everyone, but by and large, I agree with Richard Heinberg that our best option is to power down, to lower our consumption, slowly reverse our population trend, allow our population to decline a bit. Need to bring out a few facts here.
Go ahead.
In the United States, currently it takes 10 calories of fossil fuels to produce 1 calorie of food, and that's largely the input of natural gas-based fertilizers and oil-based pesticides. Also involves all the energy involved in planting, tending the crops, harvesting the crops, trucking the crops to where they're processed, processing them, then trucking the processed foods to the supermarkets. It doesn't include the energy that the average consumer uses to drive to the supermarket and then back home, nor the energy the average consumer uses to cook and prepare the food at home. But 10 calories of fossil fuels for every 1 calorie of food. And I believe it was Dr. David Pimentel out of Cornell University who ran these numbers through his computer models and deduced that in order for the U.S. to subsist without modern agriculture, without fossil fuel-based agriculture, our population in this country needs to decline by one-third. That's a big decline. That's on the order of the Great Plague.
And the world population by, was it two-thirds for the world population?
Yes, the world population would need to be reduced down to 2.5 billion.
So since it's unlikely that that's going to happen voluntarily, how do you see that playing out? I mean, is it going to be a situation where you brought up agriculture first in your discussion? Is it going to be a situation where we're going to have starvation?
Well, you have to figure in, when we're talking about the decline in energy production, So far as oil is concerned, it's not a fast thing. It's not like overnight we're not going to have oil anymore. It's a very minor decline. It's most estimates peg it at about 2% per year. There are some estimates showing an asymmetrical production curve with a steeper decline, which bring it up to 8 or even 10% decline, which you're getting very serious there. But most of the scenarios suggest about a 2% decline per year. That means that by the year 2020, we'll be producing as much oil as we produced in 1990.
So there is time at this point, although it's running out, to make some adjustments and make this transition relatively smooth or not?
Yes, if it were just a matter of oil production and the oil necessary for agriculture and, you know, the oil necessary for transportation and industry and everything else, we could probably do it. It would be difficult because we should have started doing this back in the 1970s. But, you know, we could probably do it. The big catch is, and where it's really going to hit us soon, is in the economy, because we have an economy which thrives upon continuous growth. Without continued growth, our economy tanks. That's the whole nature of our capitalist economy. And we're soon going to be looking at a day when our energy input is going to start to decline. It's only going to be 2% decline per year, but for our economy to continue to grow, we need the energy input to grow, not decline. So when that decline comes, it's going to cause economic havoc. If the economy collapses, if the world economy collapses, nobody's sure exactly how bad it's going to be, but that in itself could lead to chaos and a lot of suffering, starvation, that sort of thing. You know, you look back at the Great Depression and all the suffering that occurred back then, and there was an end to the Great Depression. But what we're talking about, there wouldn't be an end to it.
So you think the role of our leaders, they're one of the major roles they should be playing right now is getting the society in the mindset of the fact that we're not going to have the same situation, the same kind of economy.
Yes, and the likelihood of our leaders doing that is very small. Our leaders and our media don't want to present this problem accurately to the American people or to the world public, because if they do, there will be a market panic, and the stock market will suddenly drop, especially stock of the oil companies, the automobile manufacturers, the airlines, any company that has a big demand for oil is going to drop once the public becomes aware of just how serious this problem is. They don't want to see that, which is why they have not, you won't hear them speak the words peak oil. And if you hear it spoken in the mass media, they will not discuss all of the implications for it. So it's a problem. It's sort of a catch-22.
The growth economy and the global interrelated, interconnected economy are obviously not compatible with the peak oil decline or with the oil decline. What do you think we should be doing right now, even on a local level, to prepare? Because I was thinking you talked about the population situation, and so to help with the problem, you have to look at the population actually becoming smaller But if you look at traditional agricultural societies, they've always depended on large families. And so it sounds like what we'd need to do is, instead of looking at it on a family basis, to look at it as a community basis and have, you know, the community itself kind of work the farm, own the farm, produce the food.
Yes, that's if we're going to get through this in anything like a free democracy, then we're going to have to start implementing change on a local community level. There are a number of things people can do in their communities. You can get involved in your community starting up community vegetable gardens on vacant lots and other areas where you know, the people in the surrounding neighborhood jointly take care of the garden and jointly share in the produce. You could play Johnny Appleseed with apple seeds, you know, pear seeds, peach seeds, cherry pips, perennial vegetables, roots, tubers. You could even donate a little money or time into purchasing and planting saplings or vines in the case of grapes, or bushes and brambles, you know, runners in the case of strawberries. You could get involved in a Food Not Bombs type project where you organize local picnics and advertise local picnics and invite anybody in the area, including homeless and hungry people, to just take part in the picnic. You lay out the food, everyone serves themselves, and you all just basically have a good time. Support farmers markets, community-supported agricultural combines, CSAs. There are farms where, for a yearly subscription price, members are given a percentage of the produce. And sometimes the members even pitch in on the harvesting. And the farmers usually tell you, you know, what you can do to preserve the produce as they give it to you. You could start up community transportation networks. Those will probably become a lot more popular as gas prices go up. And not just carpools to and from workplaces, but to shopping centers and elsewhere. You could start bicycle co-ops to provide bicycles for members, or to rent them temporarily to non-members. You know, support local businesses. That kind of goes without saying. You could form co-ops for any sort of essential services that are needed in a community. Any sort of community activities such as, you know, barn dances, music or art festivals, local theater, all that sort of thing, it not only needs to be supported, but it also gives you a place where you can socialize with like-minded people, and it gives an outlet for artists where they can reach audiences and hopefully inspire them with visions of where they can take their community. Community refurbishing co-ops. You could start a co-op to remodel homes in your community for greater energy efficiency, or to erect or refurbish community centers, or possibly even erect shelters for the homeless. Community energy production co-ops. You could put together a co-op to put up some wind turbines or solar cells or even a hydroelectric facility or even geothermal if it's suitable in your area. You know, there's a lot of activities that you can get involved in to help prepare not just yourself, but your local area, your local community.